This is Radio Boston. I'm Yasmin Ammer in for Tiziana Deering. We start today in the governor's office. Maura Healey was inaugurated a month ago. So maybe you're curious about what's been on her calendar or whether she signed any contracts. Maybe you're wondering who she's been emailing or talking to. Totally fair questions. But you may or may not get access to any of those records, and that's because only Governor Maura Healey's office can decide what and how much you get to see. In Massachusetts, the governor's office claims exemption from the state's public records law. We're just one of two states where this is the case. Healey has pledged greater transparency in office, and she says this includes a lighter touch when it comes to releasing records. But last month, she said she would not introduce legislation to remove that claimed exemption from her office. Instead, she'd continue to look at public records requests on a case-by-case basis. In other words, just like past governors have. So here to talk more about the state's public records law and why it matters are two of our very own reporters who know this law like the back of their hands, Todd Wallach and Beth Healey. Both are investigative reporters with WBUR. Thank you both for joining us. It's nice to have you.
Thank you.
So let's start with you, Beth, because I want just to get the simple question right off the bat. What are considered public records in Massachusetts? And give some examples of ones you've requested.
Well, public records can be anything from police records to the various agencies around the state where you might want to see things. You could ask for calendar records, emails. There are all kinds of things that are of interest to the public that we ask for stories.
And so, Todd, let me bring you in here. I want to hear some examples of public records requests that you've requested and have been denied.
So one request I personally made was text messages from the governor's office, and they denied me, saying they're exempt from the public records law. People have asked for meeting calendars, visitor logs, all sorts of records from the governor's office, and even lists of phone calls of what people are complaining about, whether it's the MBTA or something else. And the governor's office has said, no, we're exempt from the public records law.
So there's a lot there. And I also want to bring in another voice. We also have with us Justin Silverman. He's the executive director of the New England First Amendment Coalition. Justin, it's so nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
So can I ask you, Massachusetts is the only state in the country where the state legislature, the state's highest court, the Supreme Judicial Court, and the governor's office claim exemption from the public records law. So why is it that some offices like Healey's can claim exemption and others can't?
Yeah, so there's a number of reasons. I should state right out of the gate that Massachusetts is one of only two states in the entire country where we have a governor that is either exempt from law or claiming exemption. So we are very much an outlier in this regard. Here in Massachusetts, the governor is citing a 1997 court case called Lambert. And this is a very brief, short opinion decided by the Supreme Judicial Court that dealt with a very specific document. It was a questionnaire submitted to what's called the Judicial Nominating Council. And in that case, the SJC said that this particular document and the council that was provided to, not subject to public records. It was a very narrow ruling, but one that every governor since 1997 has pointed to say that they are and their office is wholly exempt from the public records law. And that is the ruling, and that's the justification that Governor Healey and all of her predecessors have used to say that we're not going to provide you any of these records that you're requesting unless we choose to do so. We're under no obligation to do so.
So just to follow that up, the only way to really change that from a legal standpoint is to either have another Supreme Court case that overturns the one that you just mentioned or introduce legislation in the legislature.
Yeah, and I think the best solution would be to either change or clarify the law to make explicitly clear that the governor's office is subject to the public records law, because ultimately this isn't about Governor Healey. It's about all governors, past, present, future, making sure that we have the transparency we need within that office to know what our governors are doing, how they're crafting policy, why they're making the decisions that are being made, and to ultimately hold them accountable if they do something that's not in the public's interest.
Mm. Last year, Governor Healey told GBH that she would she wouldn't claim an exemption, and she would support legislation to at least cut back on whatever exemptions that was previously claimed by governors. So a promise to be more open and transparent. Last month, though, she also told GBH that she doesn't need to file that legislation in her office and that her office would remain exempt. So a little bit of a twist there. But she did say she would have a lighter touch, seemingly indicating she'll release more. At the same time, Healey's office released a policy on the handling of public records. And I want to know, Todd, what is in that policy, that policy that she released? Anything new?
Honestly, it's very similar to the position from past governors who said, we believe that we're completely exempt from the public records law, but we're going to consider requests on a case-by-case basis. Hers looks a little more positive from a transparency standpoint in saying that we are going to try to follow the public records law and generally release what we believe is public, but it doesn't have the force of law. So if she claims an exemption, if she claims that certain records are not covered by the public records law and somebody else doesn't agree, it's very difficult to sue the governor's office. You would have to get past the argument that they're completely exempt from the public records law.
You just have to take her word for it at this point. It's really, yeah, it's not legally backed, and that's kind of the part that we keep going to. But Beth, can I bring you in and ask, Maura Healey was attorney general before then. Do you have a sense of how open she was as attorney general and if she'll maybe have the same level as governor?
You know, we had a decent time dealing with her office. Oftentimes it would seem like they were trying to be helpful, but there were a lot of records you couldn't get. For instance, sometimes you'd want details on consumer complaints and you could get sort of total numbers but not really get the complaints. And another thing for folks to remember is because she was the lawyer for the state and state entities, it meant that she was in the position of protecting various entities from releasing their information. Mm-hmm. One example, when we did a story about bad health care in the jails and people were dying in our county jails, sometimes sheriffs would be sued. Well, the AG is the lawyer for the sheriffs. So when you would try to find out what large settlements taxpayers were paying for to pay out sheriffs, the AG would withhold that information. Now, that's, you know, that whether this is the kind of thinking that is going to be going into the governor's office, we don't know yet.
Yeah, it's unclear. So, Justin, is there a danger in letting what gets released or not up to the person whom the public records are about? And I want to know if you've seen cases where officials have adjusted or withheld records that should have been damaging to themselves or their official reputations.
Yeah, so I think it's important to remember that these public record laws are extremely valuable to all of us because they provide the level of transparency we need to understand how our government is operating and whether it's working in our best interest. And I mentioned earlier that Massachusetts and Michigan are the only two states where we're having this issue of governors being exempt or claiming to be exempt from public records law. And I think what's happened in Michigan in recent years is a cautionary tale as to what might happen here. And it goes back to the Flint water crisis. To this day, crisis began 8 years ago. To this day, there still has not been a public accounting of what the governor in that state knew at the time, the decisions that the governor made during that crisis. And granted, a crisis of that magnitude hasn't happened here, and hopefully it won't. But that said, we're only a couple years out from the height of the pandemic. We had a governor, Governor Baker at the time, issuing executive orders. And because we have governors citing Lambert, saying they're exempt from the public records law, we're really at an information deficit as to why in that case did the governor make the decisions that he did? Why were these executive orders issued? And moving forward, if we ever do find ourselves in another crisis, we're really going to have a difficult time understanding why our governor is making the decisions that she is and moving forward from there.
I just want to bring our audience up to speed. We're talking about accessing public records in Massachusetts with two of our WBUR investigations reporter, Beth Healey and Todd Wallach, along with Justin Silverman, who is the executive director of the New England First Amendment Coalition. Todd and Beth, let me go back to you because I'm wondering, it's still early in the year, but have you already requested public records, Todd?
I did. I requested a few records from the governor's office, including calendars from her first 2 days in office, which she provided. There are some gaps, so I don't know if she just had free time in the schedule or if they withheld some details. Also asked for some of the legal bills for law cases that the governor's office have been involved in, and she also provided those. So that is a really good sign. But getting back to her record as attorney general, she also defended state police when state police refused to release police reports and records of police troopers who were accused of drunk driving. So there may be cases where her office in the future claims that records are exempt under parts of the law and people disagree. And again, there's not much ability to sue the governor's office as long as the governor's office is considered completely exempt.
I say this with the utmost respect and admiration, but yes, absolutely. Todd Wallach and Beth Healey are both thorns in the side of administrations because they request so many public records, but that is what good journalism is all about.
I can also give you a good example of how records from the governor's office would have been helpful in the past. Mm. So years ago when I worked for the Boston Globe, I wanted to know who served on state boards. I was curious if it's all the same people, if it's friends of the governor. The governor's office, it was Deval Patrick at the time, refused to give me the full database of who's on each state board, and there's 700 of them. And they said, instead, they pointed me to 700 separate lists. So it was really hard to make sense of it. I wound up having to write a computer program that downloaded all 700 separate lists, parsed it and pulled it into a spreadsheet and analyzed it. And when I did that, I wound up finding that a third of the people on state boards weren't there. They were vacant, or they were people whose terms had officially expired long ago. At least one was dead. And I found it had a huge consequence that mattered for people. There were boards that weren't meeting month after month after month, so people couldn't get licenses. They couldn't get rulings on disciplinary cases. There were other boards that were meeting without a quorum, illegally, so all of their decisions could have been challenged.
So can I bring you in, Justin, and say you touched a little bit upon this, but I want to ask you just to clarify for people who aren't, you know, journalists or specifically deal with like First Amendment in Massachusetts. But why is having a transparent public records law important?
Right. Thanks for asking that. That's a really important question and one that I think everyone should understand that this isn't a journalism issue per se. Yes, journalists very much take advantage of the public records law and use it for their work. But this is an issue, a bipartisan issue, I should mention, that affects everyone in this state. The decisions of the governor affect all of us, and we all as citizens and residents of Massachusetts need to know why those decisions are being made. These are government officials that represent us or working on our behalf or should be. And the only way that we can make sure that they're making good decisions and representing our interests well is to know why they're making the decisions they are, to understand the data that might be backing a particular policy that's being proposed, to understand the communication that's occurring before these policies are proposed or actions are taken. And without that information, without a strong public records law that provides us the documents and information we need to get that insight, we're left in the dark. We're left with secrecy, quite frankly, and we're not going to be able to have the understanding of government that we need and that we're entitled to.
Mm. So Justin Silverman, thank you so much. Justin is the executive director of the New England First Amendment Coalition. I really appreciate you being here to talk about this.
Thank you.
And then also with us were Beth Healey, WBUR investigations reporter, along with WBUR investigations reporter Todd Wallach. Thank you so much also for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The average price of a home in Massachusetts is nearly $600,000. That's 50% more than the national average. And part of the reason it's so expensive is because there's just no supply. There's really, really low supply. So, simple question. Why not just build more?
There is a ton of money spent without even anything to really show for it other than pieces of paper.
You just heard from Boston developer Sean McReynolds, whose mixed income project in Chelsea cost millions before construction even began. So many factors have gotten us to this point, and we'll address some of those in a moment. But the state has offered a solution, or part of a solution. Massachusetts is enforcing new zoning guidelines that require MBTA communities to increase density near transit zones, so building more housing there. There are 175 MBTA communities from Worcester and north to Salisbury. And so far, all but seven of those communities have submitted their plans to build more units. So here in the studio with us to talk about this and other potential solutions, we're looking for the glimmers of hope here to our severe housing shortage is Jesse Kansen-Beninov, Executive Director of Abundant Housing Massachusetts. He has 20 years of experience in Massachusetts housing and community development. Jesse, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So, briefly tell us what your organization does.
Yeah, Abundant Housing Massachusetts is a statewide pro-housing organization. We believe that Massachusetts is for everyone and that every community in the state should be open and welcoming to all, regardless of race or income, age, ability, any other number of life circumstances and identities. And that's not the case in many communities across our state. In particular, many communities utilize what we call exclusionary zoning rules that keep out new types of homes, anything other than large luxury single-family homes from their borders. And that has the impact of actually limiting who has access to live in those communities. That's why we see so many towns across Massachusetts that are disproportionately to the demographics of the region or state, white, wealthier homeowners. We're trying to integrate the state and build more housing opportunity for all and make housing more affordable.
I was just going to ask you this big question that we could probably spend the rest of the hour on, but you already started answering the how did we get here? I mean, the shortage right now is, I think, around 200,000 housing units, according to some estimates, and we'll need 500,000 by 2040. So how is there a simple answer to how we got here?
There's not necessarily a simple answer. There's a lot of factors that play into it. But you're absolutely right. The reality is that our housing crisis in Massachusetts is driven disproportionately by the fact that we have not built enough homes in our state for a generation. In the 30 years prior to 1990, we built about 900,000 homes in Massachusetts. In the 30 years since 1990, we've built about half that. And that's at a time where our population has grown. We've added new jobs. People have moved to our state. And so that's a major factor that's driving this crisis, the lack of supply of homes for everyone across the income spectrum and across the state.
So we were just talking about one of the solutions, and I want to highlight that's just one because it's not a silver bullet. There's no silver bullet. But that's building more housing in MBTA communities. That requirement was under Governor Charlie Baker, and now Governor Maura Healey is pushing that requirement. And an MBTA community is just any community that's around transit stations, commuter rails, all that. But Jesse, can the state force communities to build more housing, and specifically more affordable housing? Like, how powerful is the state when municipalities have a lot of the power?
Yeah, that's absolutely that's a great question. We do really pride ourselves on local control here in Massachusetts. And so getting to the point where the state is actually telling communities that they have to do something different is proving to be a difficult conversation at times. But, you know, I think as we've seen in recent days, as more towns who are covered by this law have submitted their action plans to comply with it, all but seven of the 175, I think it's showing progress towards that and progress towards a recognition that we need to take at least a regional in Eastern Massachusetts approach and work across communities to help build more homes for everyone to make it more affordable. The problem that we have with such a shortage of homes is that we force people across the economic spectrum into competition with each other for that very limited supply of homes. And so when we're not building across the region, that's really pricing low and working class households out. Wealthier folks are always going to win in the competition for limited supply of homes, bid up the cost of housing. We've seen that in home ownership, where people offer all cash, well over asking. We've even seen that in recent years in the rental market, at least here in the city of Boston, where wealthier renters are offering landlords even more. And so this is what the lack of supply of homes is driving. It's driving displacement across our region. And so that's what this law needs to address.
I just have to add an anecdote. I really do have to add it. But when one of my friends was selling his home and got a free trip to Iceland as the icing on the cake to his already over asking. So just the absurdity of the housing market. I had to share that one. But I want to play a piece of sound because our producer, Bart Tachi, spoke with the developer who you heard at the beginning, Sean McReynolds, the president of the Joseph J. Cochran Company, about that project in Chelsea called Inez Apartments. So that's mixed income, and it took 5 years to break ground, some because of complications due to COVID, but some because of this reason.
At the very beginning, it had to go through a rezoning, and that took a lot of time and effort to get the municipal and community leaders on board with the need for upzoning this particular area.
So I hear this frustration from a lot of developers, and that is because you have no idea the amount of forms and money and time it takes to even, like, before you even get the first shovel into the ground. And I'm sure that's really frustrating, but I'm wondering, in this case, the new zoning law, MBTA, doesn't make things easier for developers? And can we make things easier for developers going forward?
This law should make it easier for us to build a variety of homes across eastern Massachusetts, because what it does is require that these 175 communities adopt zoning where multifamily housing is allowed as of right, which means without the extensive either rezoning or special permits or other zoning variances that are often required to do multifamily housing in these communities. And so you said at the top that this developer had to spend millions before they even broke ground. This should cut down on that once these multifamily as of right zoning districts are allowed. Because what happens when we maintain this very complicated system for building homes is that the costs, those millions of dollars, even before you break ground, it gets passed on in the form of higher rents or sales prices to the future owners. And again, that's what's driving our housing affordability crisis in the state. So absolutely, this new law and the fact that it's requiring multifamily, meaning apartments, whether rental or ownership as of right, should make a big step in reducing the cost of building a variety of homes for families across the income spectrum across eastern Massachusetts.
I want to bring in another voice. Jocelyn, also in the studio with us, is Jocelyn De Leon at Estrada. She's the vice president of the Alliance for Business Leadership, and also happens to be in her late 20s looking to buy a home, as I understand.
Yes, trying to buy a home.
So, Jocelyn, why don't you first tell me about the work you do with the Alliance for Business Leadership, and then we'll jump on to the whole personal story thing.
Sure thing. So the Alliance for Business Leadership is a nonprofit membership organization for business leaders who are committed to social responsibility. I lead our educational programming work and also our policy work. And we have our fingers in a couple of different policy areas, but we predominantly focus on housing, transportation, and climate and clean energy because we see those issues as most impacting residents of Massachusetts, our workforce, and the state's economic competitiveness.
So you're kind of getting local businesses in on this to focus on this as an issue, but also put like their political will maybe behind some of the legislation or some of the policy that's going on around housing.
You got it. Because, oh, sorry, I was just going to add that our members, you know, are seeing this day to day in their employees and workforce that, you know, they're struggling with these issues, whether it's, you know, trying to find somewhere to live that's affordable for them or trying to even get to their job in the first place.
Yeah, it's becoming a real issue for employers. I can attest to that just being a business reporter and talking to them. But this is what I want to hear. Okay. And you can be as honest. You can just complain if you want. Tell me about that home search.
So I've been trying to buy a home with my brother because I really see that as the only means at this time to be able to afford to buy a home. And we've started this process over a year ago, but in earnest, you know, started looking at houses in May 2022, and we're still looking. We have wonderful realtors who have been working with us, but it's been a pretty enlightening process and certainly frustrating at times.
Do you know, like, how many you've looked at so far or how many offers you've been able to put down or any?
I've lost count on the how many open houses I've been to. I think at this point probably have put in 6 offers or so. I think the first house we looked at, which we were like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. It looks just like the house that we were raised in Lawrence. You know, we put in an offer and it ended up going $65,000 over asking. And there was over 40 offers in.
40.
And that's when we were like, oh my gosh, you know, we know how competitive it is, but we didn't realize it until we were in it.
Can I ask where you're looking?
I'm exclusively looking in the city of Haverhill.
Oh, okay. So, I like, what does that, is MB, well, let me back up here. I want to know, is the MBTA an important factor in your search? What are important factors in your search?
Having a commuter rail station in close proximity to where I live is absolutely important to me. When we created the list of what are we looking for, I said, I need a commuter rail station because I commute into the city about, you know, 2 times a week, if not more, for my job. And I'm thankful that they provide, you know, free commuter rail benefits so that I can take the train in.
Can I ask you to describe that feeling when you just put in an offer on the house? It's exciting because I can relate to it. Mm-hmm. I haven't been lucky yet. But what does it feel like to get that call and be like, not this time, maybe next time?
I mean, I would be lying if I said it wasn't sad, but I try to be hopeful and think, you know, what's meant to be will be. So that's why we're continuing on with the search, even though it's taken this long and has been so hard. I'll add, you know, we did have an offer accepted towards the end of the year, and we had an inspection, which I know is rare in this market. And I'm so thankful because we found out, you know, there were serious foundational issues and we weren't, you know, willing to be able to take that risk on. And it really flags for me, like, I was afraid when I found out about those foundational issues and thought, you know, all of those people who waived inspections, like, I'm afraid of what they're going to find out about their homes.
A lot of people do take that risk, though. Yeah. I've actually had realtors tell me to just don't do inspection. It'll make you so much less competitive. Have you ever felt tempted to do that?
We've thought about it, but no, we've in all of our offers, we haven't waived inspection. And, you know, that might be part of the reason why it's taken so long, but we're just not willing to take on that risk. You know, this is a big financial investment that we're trying to make.
Yeah, the last thing you want to do is just pour all your savings and then discover that you have like $100,000 worth of repairs to do. But Jesse, just to bring you back in, you listened to Jocelyn's story. I'm sure it's not new to you in the 20 years you've been doing this. How often do you hear this and like just talk about the frequency and how it's changed since you've been doing this work in the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly common story. I mean, particularly for folks that, you know, don't come from families with lots of means or parents that can or you know, other family members that can give them a down payment. I mean, you know, our sort of middle income folks are really priced out of the market. And the point I think that's so important is that it's not just here in Boston and Cambridge and Brookline. It's not here just in the urban core. I mean, Jocelyn's story is about Haverhill and the Merrimack Valley. And we're seeing it all over the region. It's only gotten worse in the 20 or so years that I've been in this field. I mean, I remember when I started working as a community organizer in Somerville in 2003 on housing issues. You know, Somerville was still a place that working class families could afford to buy a home, although it was beginning to change even at that point. And certainly, that's not what Somerville is anymore. You know, we're seeing it again. It's going across the region and across the state. I mean, we're here mostly talking about the MBTA communities law, but there is a severe housing crisis on Cape Cod and the islands, which isn't covered by the MBTA communities law. And they're really struggling to understand, you know, how can we they build more homes even out there.
Can I ask you, so we have this MBTA communities law, and I'm glad we're talking about it because it is like a little glimmer of hope, and I do want to talk about solutions. Are there any that come at the top of your mind when it comes to solutions, like things we just like immediately need to do or things that you would even advise, you know, the governor, the mayor? What do you want to see?
Yeah, we really need to have a conversation about how do we make it so that across the state, we can build a variety of homes to serve a variety of life needs. I think we have a very patchwork of laws around the state that allow accessory dwelling units, that's like backyard cottages, to be built. Some towns ban it altogether. Some towns have cumbersome processes you can go through. We need to follow suit of states like Maine and California that have legalized accessory dwelling units across their states and do that here in Massachusetts. We also need to have a conversation about how can we reform our zoning processes, not just in the city of Boston, which Mayor Wu has begun talking about, but across the state to allow more affordable housing and also naturally occurring affordable housing, smaller apartment buildings that tend to be more moderately priced to build and to rent or own. And so thinking about the classic triple-decker that we see across the state of Massachusetts, which traditionally was an affordable type of home in our region, that's essentially banned through most cities and states where, rather cities and towns where you see them in the state. So think about how can we bring that back as an affordable opportunity to be built all around our region. So I think those are some strategies we need to talk about and how to do it as of right without cumbersome zoning processes that add substantial costs to the construction and ultimate rental or sales prices.
Well, Jesse Kantzen-Benenov, Executive Director of Abundant Housing Massachusetts, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Jocelyn De Leon Estrada, Vice President of the Alliance for Business Leadership, thank you for being here and good luck in your housing search. I am rooting for you.
Thank you so much.
Let's take a walk. Imagine you're standing on Beach Street in Boston. In front of you is the Chinatown Gate. You take a right down Hudson Street, walking past the Mary Shuhu Park and the Happy Family Food Market. You reach an intersection and take another right on Nealon Street and another right on Tyler Street. And soon you're surrounded by ramen and boba shops. This is sound here from WBUR Simone Rios, who is in Chinatown. That's where you are. But less than 100 years ago, you would have been in the middle of Boston's Little Syria, or Syriatown. At its height in the 1930s, 15,000 Syrians lived there and around Boston. Today, there's few remnants of what was the hub of Syrian life in the city. But there's a new exhibit at MIT that looks to document and preserve the history and the culture of Little Syria, who lived there, and their community as part of our collective hidden history. Here to talk more about that exhibit and their research into the community are the exhibit's co-creators. That would be Lydia Harrington, postdoctoral research fellow at MIT. Lydia, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for having us.
Nice to have you. And then Chloe Bordewick, public history postdoctoral associate at BU Center for Anti-Racist Research. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you, Yasmin.
Okay, I am really excited to talk about the history of Little Syria, but I do need to start in the present world first. Right now, more than 11,000 people have been killed in Turkey and Syria because of a 7.8 magnitude earthquake and its aftershocks. How are you thinking about preserving this history? And I know you started this exhibit before that really terrible event. So how are you thinking about the history as it unfolds in the present for Syrians right now? Go ahead.
Since it just happened, we're still, you know, trying to make sure our friends are okay and trying to wrap our heads around what's happening. So we would encourage people to donate to any charitable aid organization you can donate to, such as Turkish Philanthropy Funds for Turkey or Molham. It's MOLHAM, a fund you can look up online. There's plenty of other ones also. So I don't know, Chloe, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Lydia said, this is the urgent thing to think about right now. But I think also, I mean, to connect this to the history that we'll be talking about with you today, I mean, the community that we're focused on has a long history of giving back to the communities mm-hmm. that they came from in Lebanon and Syria. And they did that, you know, during World War One. They did that subsequently during the civil war in Lebanon. And so there is a really long history of that through community organizations and through churches in particular in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm.
So when we say Syria, I think Americans come with these preconceived notions of the country and its people. And in preparing for this segment, we actually Googled Syria. We were just curious. And the People Also Ask section, we got these top results. What's the problem in Syria? War in Syria? Why can't Americans go to Syria? Just these words, war, famine, refugees. These are the things that do come in mind for Westerners. But your research shows a world of culture and community. I want you to talk about that and the importance of like this preservation when you were putting together this exhibit.
Yeah, we would say that, you know, there were kind of similar things to today that made people migrate from what was greater Syria, basically Lebanon and Syria today, such as famine and war and persecution. But, you know, we've want to show also like very positive things that Syrians brought with them, as well as, you know, their contributions to Boston since, in fact, the 18th century. But they came more during the 1880s through the early 20th century. So we wanted to show things in the exhibit that showed everyday life and well-known people in the neighborhoods. So we have things like Anthony Abdelahed's oud, which is like a guitar. He was a well-known Syrian American musician, things like cookbooks, things like photos of churches, Arabic language newspapers, showing that, you know, they were still tied to their homeland, but also making a new life as Americans in Boston.
So can you paint a picture for us a little bit? What was Little Syria like? Where was it? We already mentioned it was in Chinatown, but what were the streets like as far as you can tell from like old pictures and things that you found?
Yeah, I mean, the community started off, you know, as Lydia said, in the late 1880s, that's when we see the first Syrians. And when we say Syrian, we mean contemporary Syria and Lebanon. They were then all known as Syrians arriving in Boston. And initially they settled in that area right around the Chinatown Gate. Of course, in what's now Ping An Alley, as well as Hudson Street, as you mentioned. So Hudson and Tyler Streets in those early decades would have been filled with many of the brick buildings that you still see on those streets today, generally with 4 to 6 families, often a shop on the ground floor selling dry goods, and general store, and then you would have storage in the basement. And yeah, many families initially cramming into the upper floors and sharing usually a single outdoor toilet. And then as the years passed, the community expanded and somewhat moved actually out of what's now Chinatown in the South Cove across today's Central Artery to down Shawmut Ave, Union Park, at Bradford Street, et cetera. And so by the 1920s and 30s, you know, Chinatown was becoming more and more Chinatown, and Little Syria was increasingly kind of centered down Shawmut Ave. And there, you know, those were in many cases homes that had been built in the mid-19th century as fairly elite properties, as kind of what you see today, but had become more accessible to middle and even lower middle income families. And by then, many Syrians were actually renting out homes around Shawmut Ave to other newly arrived immigrants mm-hmm. and laborers and so forth in Boston.
So Lydia, can I bring you back in and ask, is there a specific artifact that you found interesting, surprising, holds special meaning to you?
There is one, actually. We've been talking together a lot about, and that is a talismanic scroll that actually is not in the current exhibition, but will be at our upcoming version at Mass Historical Society, and you can look out for that in April. And we'll have a live event with some members of the community April 19th. But the scroll basically was found in St. George's Orthodox Church, which is now in West Roxbury, having had moved earlier in the mid-20th century from Little Syria. And that's, you know, a scroll that a priest would carry with him for protection. And I'm particularly interested because, you know, it's in Arabic. You have, you know, these letters that correspond to numbers. It's kind of mysterious to look at, but just, you know, having like prayers asking for protection from God. And it's very similar to Muslim, like Islamic talismanic scrolls. So just seeing like all these connections in different religions and cultures in the Middle East is very interesting. And that's also something that the current priest had sent to Lebanon to be read and restored. And now they have it, and he's graciously offered to let us show it in our upcoming version of the exhibition. So just like lots of stuff that we never expected to find that connects Syria and the U.S.
I think it's one of the most obvious ways to see remnants of Little Syria in Boston is to go to these churches, a lot of them in West Roxbury. That's where a lot of the culture still holds, and you see a lot of it there. So I'm glad you brought up that piece. So we know the neighborhood Little Syria started to disappear after the 1930s. I'd love to hear a little bit about why that is.
Sure. There are a couple of different reasons. I mean, one was generational and socioeconomic change. You know, as people established themselves here and time passed, initially often working as peddlers, you know, which means selling things like lace and underwear and pajamas out of either your cart or your car. Then people established themselves and, you know, were able to both buy homes outside of the original neighborhood and to move into other white collar professions. But also one major factor was urban change, urban renewal, the so-called urban renewal project of the Boston Redevelopment Authority. Many are familiar with the impact that the BRA had on the West End. It was a little bit more complex in the South End. There was intent to raise much of the neighborhood and take down the buildings and reconstruct new ones there. In fact, many of those projects were never completed, but the consequence was that people were left with a great degree of uncertainty. Properties were purchased, destroyed, et cetera. And so the fabric of the neighborhood was torn apart in part by that project.
So just to get our listeners up to speed, in this week's Hidden History, we're talking about Boston's former Little Syria, a community that was in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And you just heard from Chloe Bordewick, Public History Postdoctoral Associate at Boston University Center for Anti-Research, and along with us, Lydia Harrington, who is a research fellow at MIT, and both are co-curators of the MIT exhibit on Little Syria. So, Lydia, can I ask you, what do you hope people take away from this exhibit and the work you're doing in general on Little Syria?
That's a great question. I think I hope just in addition to seeing the value of this neighborhood and contributions of Syrian and Lebanese Americans to Boston and Eastern Massachusetts history and current reality, as well as just like seeing your neighborhood in a new perspective, like going down the street and thinking like, oh, what's this building? I'm going to do a little research on it, ask somebody who runs the store, what's the history? And you might find something like totally unexpected. So I think both of those are things I'd like people to take away.
That's what I love about Hidden History. It makes your surroundings so much more exciting.
Definitely.
It just, you know, you just like look around and you're like, oh, this was once something else. But can I also ask you, Lydia, and then I'll ask you, Chloe, but what are some ways in which this community influenced Boston as we know it today? Like, how does Little Syria live on? Lydia, let me start with you.
Well, I think part of the way it lives on is in the suburbs, and you see how all these communities, like it's not just Syrians, you can look at Jewish communities, Irish, Chinese. It's like part of a larger, you know, trend of American immigration to like become more economically successful and move out to the suburbs, buy a house. So if you go to places like Natick, West Rexbury, Norwood, you will find like large Syrian communities, restaurants, churches. So I think just the contribution is like, you know, spreading out the culture further out. And I mean, there's so many influences in terms of food, like food, churches, charitable organizations, music even. For example, the composer of that title song for Pulp Fiction, Dick Davis, I think is his name.
Yeah.
He grew up in Little Syria, and what was the title?
It's the iconic song from Pulp Fiction. The guy who wrote it was Arab.
Yeah, that was, it's an Eastern Mediterranean tune, and his family brought it with them, and that ended up, you know, in Hollywood. So there's just so many influences that are like, we might not recognize that they're Syrian, but they are, so.
And that writer, that musician was Dick Dale, but he did have an Arab name that I can't
Richard
remember.
Richard Mansour was his original birth name.
There we go.
But
Chloe, I would love to also hear you weigh on this. Like, what are some ways that you think live on? And I know like part of the discussion here is also surrounding identity, because something listeners may or may not know is these Syrians, when they first came here, people didn't really know how to treat them, what to do with them. But eventually they assimilated so much that they were considered white by the U.S. government. And still to this day, Middle Easterners and North Africans are considered white partially because of the earliest Syrian immigrants.
I think one point in terms of, you know, contributions that we should highlight is community organizing and political activism, because this is certainly not a community that was ever politically quiescent. And, you know, we might be familiar with people in the cultural realm, like Khalil Gibran, for example, who also is a Bostonian.
Famous poet.
You might be familiar with the poet Khalil Gibran. He's got a plaque in front of Boston Public Library. But there were also people who sort of unsung political activists and community organizers whose contributions, I think, have made really, I mean, and on the one hand, you know, they were active in advocating for the community against the BRA or with the BRA, as the case may have been. For example, Peters Park off of Shawmut Avenue is named for Sadie Peters, who was, although you might not recognize from her name, born in Lebanon and was active as a community organizer during the BRA period. So people like that, I think, are really worth recognizing. And that those are some of the kinds of people we hope that this project will bring to the fore a little bit more. And to speak to your question about kind of the racialization of the community, too, this was something that, you know, the interest in
we might actually have to leave it right there, as much as I would have wanted to talk about it. I know I brought up a bit. But that was Chloe Bordewick, Public History Postdoctoral Associate, Boston University Center for Anti-Racist Research. Thank you so much.
And
Lydia Harrington, she is a postdoctoral research fellow at MIT. Both are co-curators of the MIT exhibit on Little Syria History in Boston. Go see it. Thank you so much. That's our show for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Yasmeen Ammer, in for Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.